watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. In our reading last week from Genevieve Vaughn's book on the gift economy, she said that one of the central questions of our time is, what is the relationship of the one to the many? The ideology that dominates the society becomes what is normal, what is taken for granted, what is spoken about as the natural order of things, against which all else is measured. Markets and exchange hold such a place in our society. The establishment will debate how these things should be conducted and managed, but not whether they are intrinsically desirable. They're sometimes spoken about as if they were a natural consequence of evolution and in accordance with natural laws as understood by science, or alternatively, as divinely ordained, even written about in the Bible. That is interesting because the earliest known writing, the cuneiform of Babylonia, began as a form of accounting of the king's treasury. We have nothing handed down to us in writing from the depths of our history before societies had kings and treasuries. In fact, our bias is so extreme that we do not count past or present societies as civilized without evidence of palaces and treasuries. Discounting sophisticated ethics, aesthetics, or practical understanding of the natural world. In the United States and similar societies, there's a different twist in that commerce as a central organizing principle for society is justified in the name of democracy as a reflection of our collective desire. But who is we? Our history, though not widely taught, shows one group after another persecuted for opposition to the dominance of commerce. As well as the development of methods to deliberately create a social consensus through public relations, advertising, and schooling. Our first speaker, who will comprise the bulk of this week's show, is an author and journalist whose work has focused on the market and economics as a religion with its own fundamentalisms, and the way that this has become a crusade advanced by both propaganda and force against a growing counter-consensus rejecting this social vision and practice. She's Naomi Klein, and her most recent book, The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism, focuses on the relationship of commerce to violence. This book has brought her a great deal of attention, and she's been interviewed frequently on Democracy Now!, as well as other more establishment media outlets. She illuminates the connections between ideologies and events that are normally spoken of as if they were separate and unrelated spheres. This week, you're going to hear a speech she gave at Seattle Town Hall at the end of September, very much as a member of this counter-consensus. I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. Thanks to Mike McCormick of Mind Over Matters and Talking Stick TV for capturing this event.
I was so glad to hear that round of applause for Seattle. This project for me really is about my attempt to try to revive that spirit, that moment, which to me was such a high point, much vilified as our movement has been. It was such a high point because it was a moment when the economic ideology of unfettered corporatism, of corporate rule, didn't have a disguise. Do you know what I mean by that? You know, in the 70s, the disguise was fighting communism. You know, if there were crimes committed in Chile, it wasn't for capitalism. It was against communism. It was a hot front of the Cold War. And the ideology behind it, this desire for total corporate domination, didn't have to speak its name. It hid behind its wars. It hid behind its crusade. And that carried it through much of the 80s as well, didn't it? As this ideological crusade climbed the continent from the southern cone of Latin America up to Central America, violence following all the way. These weren't crimes committed for the advancement of American mining companies, of American oil companies. They were hot fronts of the Cold War. They were a war against totalitarian communism. The ideology itself didn't speak its name. And then after the Berlin Wall fell, there was another disguise. It was globalization. It was technology. It was integration. And then suddenly, in 1999 in Seattle, the disguises dropped off. And it wasn't about fighting communism, and it wasn't about the internet. It was about rapacious corporate greed and people coming together and unmasking the system and debating it in the streets and storming this experts-only enclave and saying we don't need to be economists to say that we don't want our water privatized, to demand decency in our workplaces and democracy in our workplaces, to demand a future for our planet that is sustainable and safe. And so this much vilified movement that was accused of being incoherent. I notice we're either conspiracy theorists or incoherent, nothing in between. My book is now being criticized for drawing too many connections. But of course, my friend Seamus Milne, who is the op-ed editor at The Guardian, he calls it the cock-up theory of history. That I didn't realize there was a cock-up theory of history, but the theory is that everything happens just because of some big cock-up, some big mess-up. It's a series of mistakes. And if you actually say that there are motives and interests behind it, you are a conspiracy theorist. So there was that moment, that unmasked moment, when we weren't talking about the disguises. We were talking about the agenda. We were talking about the real agenda. And all the disguises fell away, and it was unmasked and so ugly, so ugly. And it started to shrivel up. And every time the organs, the institution, the international institutions that advance this ideology of total corporate rule, privatization of everything, of water, of life, of every intellectual property, of culture, deregulation when it is in the interests of corporate profit and hyper-regulation when it is in the interests of corporations and profit, cuts to those aspects of the state that help welfare, education, healthcare, super funding of those arms of the state that hurt prisons, military. This was the agenda that we unmasked on the streets, and then we followed them to the IMF, the World Bank, the G8. It was a moment. And then there came a shock and a new crusade, a new mask, and that was the war on terror. And we were told, we don't care about economics anymore. We in Canada, where I live, we were told security trumps trade. Trade doesn't matter anymore. It's all about security. We didn't realize that Homeland Security was going to be a $200 billion business, that this was the new trade, the trade in borders and surveillance and weapons. So I'm happy to be here in Seattle. I'm happy to hear your applause for yourself and for that moment, because I think we need to unmask this ideology once again. This is something this city does well. It has a world track record for doing it, and we need to do it again because there's a new disguise. There's a new disguise. There's a new way of changing the subject. I start the book with a quote from an Argentine novelist who says, any change is a change in the subject, and it goes both ways, right? The subject changed on us. We were told that privatization, deregulation, globalization, it was also yesterday. That was a headline on September the 12th, 2001. Globalization is so yesterday. Be quiet. Go back to your homes. Don't talk about this anymore. But any change for us is also a change of the subject because we can't win on their terms with their language, with their crusades. It needs to be on our terms. We need to name things for what they are. I left North America after September 11th, partly because of seeing our movement so fearful and so uncertain. And I suppose I ran away. I went to Argentina and lived there over a couple of years, 2002, 2003. Argentina in these years was a little bit of a magnet for exiles of the anti-corporate movement who didn't feel at home anymore in their homes. And I was part of this move, and we made a film called The Take. About a group of workers in Argentina who occupied their factories that had been closed down and turned them into workers' cooperatives. And on the night, one night we were filming a scene for The Take. And it was in this factory in Patagonia, in Neuquén, southern Argentina. Beautiful, beautiful landscape, really flat desert. And this was a tile factory. It's actually the largest tile factory in Latin America. They make bathroom tiles, kitchen tiles, because there's a lot of sand around, and they process it into tiles. And this factory had gone bankrupt. People were told that they were going to lose their jobs like so many other people in Argentina. At that point, 60% of the country had been pushed below the poverty line. They unfired themselves. They said, no, we refuse to be fired. And they moved back into their factory, and they insisted on working. It was like an anti-strike, right? Strikers withhold their labor. They insisted on providing it, turned the factory into a sustainable, democratic business. But they were constantly facing police repression, constant attempts to take back the factory so that they could sell off the machines, just continue the sort of vulturization, because there were still some valuable parts. The owners didn't want to put it to work. They just wanted to sort of milk every last dollar of it. So every worker in this factory was given a slingshot, and they were armed with these little balls that were part of actually the process of making these tiles. There were these little ceramic balls. And to make to grind the sand and turn it into the material for the tiles, they would be put in these massive machines with these tiny little ceramic balls. So they had a lot of these balls around. And everybody had like a little pouch and a little slingshot. So for our documentary, we wanted to shoot a group of the workers on the roof of this factory, looking out on the Patagonian desert, shooting their slingshots at sunset, you know, magic hour. And so we went up on the roof, and we shot these scenes. And I remember it so well because that was the night that the shock and awe bombing of Baghdad began. And it was such a strange feeling to be on that roof with our slingshots, with our medieval weapons, and looking out onto this flat horizon and imagining it stretching all the way to Baghdad, where the lights of shock and awe with so immeasurably more powerful weaponry was descending on that city. It was strange to watch the war from Argentina, but I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful for that because I think that if I hadn't been living in Argentina at that moment, I never could have written the Shock Doctrine. That's for two reasons. The first was that after the shock and awe, after that first shock, we immediately saw a second shock. And I remember reading about this in Argentina, Paul Bremer's arrival, business suit, combat boots, remember? The uniform of the new economy. And this descent of these companies like Halliburton and Bechtel, you know, being in Latin America and hearing that Bechtel had just arrived in Iraq to rebuild the water system, I mean, this means one thing. In Argentina, Bechtel is the company that privatized the water, just as it was the company that privatized the water in Bolivia. It was so controversial, it was thrown out of the country. So I wrote at the time, this is not reconstruction, it's robbery. It's robbery disguised as reconstruction. It's privatization in disguise. But it felt like there was something very new going on, because in Argentina, this economic model had just been overthrown in a massive popular uprising. You know, that's why we were there. That's why we were documenting this extraordinary phenomenon that in December 2001, while we in North America were quite paralyzed with fear, in Argentina, there was an economic meltdown, looting. People were locked out of their banks. There were scenes actually quite similar recently in the UK when a large bank closed its doors. But in Argentina, it went wild, and people, you know, lost their life savings. They attacked the banks. And then they overthrew the government. They overthrew five presidents in 2 weeks. And what was so incredible, yeah. What was so incredible about this moment was that, you know, what we in the movement against corporate domination had felt in these fleeting moments at summits when we had unmasked the system and we had held it to account outside of these meetings where the agenda was being advanced. You know, in Argentina, this happened, but it was at a national level. It wasn't just a group of activists, right? It wasn't just union leaders and environmentalists and students. It was everyone. It was millions of people. And they were going after what they called el modelo, the model. The model being the Washington consensus, the policies that I've been discussing. And that's why the cry in the streets was que se vayan todos, all of them must go, right? It was a revolt against the entire political class and its integration with the business elites and these international institutions that had been enforcing these policies. And then suddenly everybody looked at each other and went, what are we going to do now? We don't have any more politicians to throw out. And so they started organizing at the neighborhood level. But this, there did feel to us like there was a connection between the fact that Latin America, not just Argentina, but so much of the continent in that moment was in revolt against El Modelo, and that here was Paul Bremer arriving in Baghdad. By his admission, the city is still on fire, and he announces it's open for business. And he announces that Iraq is going to be a free trade zone, the freest trade zone in the world, absolutely no restrictions. He proceeds to write an entire new economic architecture for the country. He writes 100 new laws, allows foreign banks to come and go as they please, allows foreign companies to own 100% of Iraqi assets, to take 100% of their profits out. The contracts will last up to 40 years. He announces that Iraq's 200 state-owned companies will be sold off. I mean, people say this is a conspiracy. It's not a conspiracy. You can go online and read all of these edicts. The man left a paper trail. So it seemed to me that there, you know, here we were, you know, in Latin America, which had been the laboratory for so many of precisely these policies, and it was no longer possible to enforce these policies with any veneer of consent, right? Remember, just before September 11th was the Summit of the Americas in Quebec City, where there were such grand plans to make a free trade zone that would start in Alaska and go all the way down to Chile. You don't hear very much about that anymore. You know, we're told so often that our movements are ineffective, that they fail. There isn't a world leader in Latin America that would ever, at this point, come out in favor of the free trade area of the Americas. But in 2001, in April 2001, 34 heads of state went to Quebec City, and every single one of them signed on the dotted line and said, we will create this free trade zone. So that is the power of social movements, to put pressure on their politicians, because, you know, it's an absolute no-go zone. You just can't go there. So here was Latin America in revolt against this consensus that never was. And here these same policies were being imposed now with brute violence. Bomb before you buy is what I wrote at the time. Don't ask. Take on the battlefields of preemptive war. Economic shock therapy through shock and awe. This is what I mean by disaster capitalism. So it felt, there seemed to be a connection to me that we were entering a violent new phase. Precisely because there was so much opposition to these policies, that it was no longer going to advance in these polite summits in places like Seattle or Geneva or in Washington. It was going to ride on the backs of disasters. There would be no asking. There would just be taking now. I went to Iraq in that first year. When I got back from Argentina, I decided that I had to go there. And it actually had something to do with something else I learned in Argentina. I said that I don't think I could have written this book had I not lived there, had I not seen the war through the eyes of my Latin American friends. There was another element, and that other element was something I heard very often in this period in Argentina, which was, they did this to us. And at the time, I didn't understand what that meant, because as far as I knew, Argentina had never been invaded by the United States, had never been occupied. But so the analogy seemed to me to be false. You know, I knew that there had been a military dictatorship in Argentina, but it didn't seem to me that similar to what we were seeing in Iraq. But the more I learned about Argentina's history and the more I learned about the history of the southern cone of Latin America, the more I did start to see very stark similarities in what I'm calling here the shock doctrine. Because in that period, you had a series of very shocking events, of violent overthrows of regimes, particularly in Chile, which was a tremendous shock to that country because there had been 41 years of uninterrupted democratic rule. And that shock was immediately followed by what Milton Friedman called at the time economic shock treatment, which was this rapid fire, extreme country makeover, just doing it all at once. And what the Chicago Boys did in Chile was turn it into a laboratory for precisely the ideas that we now associate with the Bush administration: charter schools, privatization of Social Security, you know, a 15% flat tax. 15% flat tax was brought to Iraq by Paul Bremer in that first summer. And Michael Fleischer, who was head of private sector development, told the Iraqis, you know, I don't know what you're complaining about because the entire Republican Party is jealous of your tax code. So, you know, these countries, if you read Milton Friedman's, you know, manifesto, Capitalism and Freedom, all these policies are there. But they actually weren't possible to impose in the United States under democracy. But the first place where they escaped the textbook was Chile, and to a lesser extent, Argentina. So you had the shock of the coups, followed by the economic shock therapy. And it was also enforced, as we know, by far less metaphorical shocks, by the shocks in the torture chambers. These were torture regimes. These were regimes that used torture systematically. And not just to get information about, you know, where an underground leftist group might be hiding out. Torture was a means, as it always is, of mass communication. Torture is never fully private. You know, we talk about it taking place in the shadows, but it's not effective unless some of it leaks out, unless we hear about it, unless we get the message that this is what happens to you if you transgress. And this is what's missing from our debate about torture in this country. You know, it's all about, does it work? The 24 scenario, is the information reliable? It works. Torture works. Not necessarily in getting information out, but in its larger purpose, which is to spread fear and terror. Nothing spreads fear like torture. Nothing sends the message of obedience like you could end up in a black hole and no one will know where you are and you'll never get out and you'll lose all your rights. You know, many people around the world have gotten the message, have received the transmission that has been sent from Guantanamo, which is a public prison, is it not? It's not hidden away. It's fluorescently lit. The Pentagon photographs it and releases the photographs to the press periodically and brings journalists on guided tours. Guantanamo is transmitting to the world. You know, and some people are not aware of whether that they have gotten the message too because they don't believe themselves to be vulnerable. Many people have gotten the message. Many people have gotten the message because they know they fit the profile, because of the color of their skin, because of their religion, because of their political activity. Now, in Latin America, torture obviously played this role. We know that. And so this is what my Latin American friends were telling me, that this happened to us, that this economic model came to this part of the world through shock and terror, just as it was being brought to Iraq through shock and awe, and later the shock of the torture chamber. So a friend of mine in Argentina, Claudia Acuña, on one of my last days, she was a journalist in Buenos Aires, she said to me, blood gets in your eyes. And what she was trying to explain to me was how hard it was during the dictatorship to see that the junta had an economic program, had goals of their own, that the violence was not just sadism and was not just about repressing the country, but that they were revolutionaries, that they were revolutionaries of the right, that they had a radical program, and that this was not just a murder scene, the country where 30,000 people were disappeared. It was the site of an extraordinarily violent armed robbery, which is to say that there was a goal, that the country was being looted and it required violence to loot it. But she said, you know, the problem was that we were so focused on the terror, we were so focused on shutting down the torture chambers, so focused on kicking out the generals, that the economic project that they put in place was never our focus, and it proved stronger than the military regime itself. So we did kick them out, and we did shut down the torture chambers, but the economic project lived on. And what she was saying was, in some ways, the mind and the heart rebels against looking for a reason behind terror. And that's what she was saying about how blood gets in your eyes. Blood is blinding. Terror is blinding. And I thought of that when I went to Iraq, because I went there to cover the economic side of the war, and I was absolutely determined not to get distracted by every single bomb. And it was so hard. The first night I arrived in, you know, I would have these debates with the photographer I was working with, Andrew Stern, he's a fantastic photographer, but like every photographer, wants to go to the blast site, right? And we would have these big arguments about the politics of bomb chasing, you know, because that's what everyone was doing. And you come back with the same story. You know, war is hell. It's hideous. And so we were trying to come up with strategies. You know, okay, well, if a bomb goes off, you know, a block away we'll go. If it goes off 2 blocks away, we won't go. I mean, this was actually the negotiations we were having on our way to the country, because we had all these appointments with labor leaders and factories set to be privatized and oil workers and families who were organizing against these policies. And I knew that if we allowed ourselves to just become war correspondents, that was the only story we'd tell. And within 3 hours of our arrival, the windows of our hotel were blown out by a major bomb a block away. And of course we went. And I just remember that night thinking about Claudia and thinking about what she had told me about how blood gets in your eyes. And it really kept me focused, maybe brutally focused in a way, to try to tell this story. And it became surreal when I was in Iraq, where we would, you know, be driving down a highway and there'd be a bomb down the, a bomb would go off on the side of the road, and every car on the highway would make a U-turn to go in the opposite direction. We would be on our way to a state vegetable oil company that was supposed to be privatized, and we had an appointment with one of the workers, and our driver's going, okay, he wants to turn around, everyone's turning around, and we're going, nope, we've got to keep going. And Andy wants to stop at the bomb site, take pictures, going, nope, we're going to the vegetable factory. We're going to the vegetable oil factory. Because there is a why. There is a reason behind the violence. And I think we do need to somehow keep sight of that. When I left Iraq, the tides had turned. The four Blackwater employees who are actually in the news today, because Blackwater is being blamed for their deaths, the four Blackwater employees that were strung up on the bridge in Fallujah, that happened while I was in Iraq. And, you know, it changed everything. That was the turning point. It was the turning point because the Bush administration decided to retaliate against the entire city of Fallujah and engage in brutal collective punishment to avenge the deaths of these four mercenary soldiers. And it was the extraordinary brutality of that episode of the siege in Fallujah that decisively turned the country against the U.S. And it's never, you know, the country has been descending into increasingly complex violence ever since. I don't really use the word civil war, because I don't think that that's exactly accurate. When we left Iraq, I concluded that this experiment had failed, that this experiment in trying to create a model free market economy in the heart of the Arab world, which was the stated goal, that it had been a failure. Shock therapy through shock and awe had backfired. And the theory, Richard Armitage, the former Deputy Secretary of State, he came out a couple years ago and explained what the theory was. He said the theory was that Iraqis would be so disoriented and so overwhelmed by the bombing and by the collapse of Saddam's regime that they would be, and this is a quote, easily marshaled from point A to point B. Iraqis were not easily marshaled from point A to point B. And so I wrote a piece for Harper's. It was called Baghdad Year Zero. And it was, the subtitle was Pillaging Iraq in Pursuit of a Neocon Utopia. And it was about this quest to blank the slate in Iraq, to start over from year zero, and to build this model state, this corporate utopia, and how it had actually ironically created a ghoulish corporate dystopia, where the very corporations who had been so excited about taking advantage of this amazingly profitable economic architecture that Paul Bremer had generously laid down for them, allowing them to extract such enormous profits from the country and buy off Iraq's assets at fire sale prices, they fled the country, right? I mean, when we left, there was an evacuation going on. And it was clear, you know, at that point, you know, all there had been a bunch of big deals announced, like GM was supposed to open. It sounds absurd even now to even think it's possible, but GM was supposed to open a factory in Iraq. HSBC was planning to open branches all over Iraq. So one by one, these companies all left, right? Because by trying to create the perfect, the most perfect place in the world to do business, totally free of any restrictions, they had so decisively turned the country against them that going to a business meeting could get you beheaded. That was the world that they created. And that's not an exaggeration. That was happening. Contractors were getting beheaded. And the videos were circulating all over the internet. And that, you know, and the killing of those Blackwater security guards was a turning point for the business community, because they hire Blackwater and companies like them to protect them. So if that's what happens to the people who are supposed to protect you, you don't go to Iraq, right? I mean, the symbolism of those Blackwater guys on that bridge, their charred bodies, you know, that was the turning point for this dream of creating this free trade zone. So that's what I concluded. They tried and they failed. I'd never seen this kind of failure before. I don't think anyone had. I have reconsidered. I don't believe that Iraq is a corporate failure. I think that Plan A failed. You know, as I said, there's a paper trail. We know what Plan A was. But there was also a Plan B. And, you know, maybe it wasn't even fully articulated in the minds of the architects of the war. But the point is that this war was rigged so it couldn't fail, so it couldn't lose. And by fail, you know, I'm not talking about the Iraqi people who have obviously lost, and I'm not talking about the American taxpayers who have obviously lost. I'm talking about corporate America. Because the worse things got and the worse things get in Iraq, the more privatized this war becomes. And there is a economic boom taking place in Iraq. And there is a new economy that has emerged in Iraq. It is simply not the new economy that they had originally foreseen. It is what I call in the book the disaster capitalism complex. It is a radical new version of a corporate state, a corporate military state. Now, we know what happened with Blackwater a couple of weeks ago. We don't know exactly what happened, but the Iraqi government say that unprovoked, one of the guys got jumpy, somebody didn't stop at a checkpoint, next thing you know, 20 people are dead in a square in downtown Baghdad. The Iraqi government decides to kick out Blackwater because they say this is the seventh such incident. This is the first time we've heard about it, which is itself a chilling idea. Never any charges, of course. They've been operating totally lawlessly. So the Iraqi government says enough, not because this is a particularly brave government, but because Blackwater is so hated and is such a symbol of the absolute worst of this brutal occupation that to hold on to power, Maliki felt that he needed to take this stand against Blackwater. This is a measure of the rage at these companies in Iraq. And what do we find out? That the State Department says that the diplomatic corps cannot survive in Iraq without Blackwater. It is entirely dependent on Blackwater. So even whether or not they're guilty or not is besides the point. Blackwater can't leave, right? So this raises an interesting question. And this is what I'm referring to as the economic boom that emerged as things got worse in Iraq. Because, of course, the way in which the war was rigged so that it couldn't fail, you know, is this much maligned decision by Donald Rumsfeld to send this very pared down force and not to send more soldiers as things got worse, but to stick to his guns on his idea of this sort of lean, mean military. And there has been a corporate mission creep. So when the war began, there were 3 U.S. soldiers for every contractor. And now, There are more contractors than there are U.S. soldiers. There are 180,000 contractors in Iraq, significantly more than U.S. troops. And so as the country spirals out of U.S. control, Blackwater, which originally was on contract just to protect Paul Bremer, starts engaging in combat in Najaf against the Mahdi army. And there are allegations of all kinds of shootouts that are not just defensive, but actually fighting alongside the Marines, and in some cases, being in command. And we find out about this through scandal. I mean, we find out about the extraordinary role that Blackwater is playing when there is a massacre. Just like when we saw those horrifying photographs leaked out of Abu Ghraib, we found out that some of the interrogators in those photographs were not U.S. military interrogators, but were actually working for private corporations, Khaki and Titan. Why? Because as the country spiraled out of control, the war moved into the jails because they couldn't control the streets, so they brought the streets into the jails, rounding up thousands and thousands of Iraqis and just randomly interrogating them, but they didn't have enough interrogators, so they ordered them like pizzas from Khaki because they don't have to train them. And Khaki has some strange, vague contract with the, actually not even with the U.S. military, just with another arm of the U.S. government, where they essentially play the role of temps. They're a temp agency for the U.S. government. And they, are there to provide administrative support, which can mean anything, and was stretched to mean prison interrogation. So that's what I mean by corporate mission creep. Halliburton, the green zone is, referred to as an American zone or an international zone or, the site of the U.S. Embassy in Iraq. But, what always struck me about the green zone is that, this is science fiction. This is an entirely corporate state. Halliburton runs the roads, pest control, food, Hollywood movies, country and western night. It's like an all-inclusive luxury vacation. Or like it's like a heavily armored Carnival cruise ship, right? Parked in this sea of despair. And if you can get into, through the walls, this maze of checkpoints, there are poolside drinks. And as I said, country and western night. And it's all patrolled by private security and some U.S. soldiers in the most dangerous spots. And you'll get shot if you stand too close to the wall on the outside. What Halliburton did there and is doing in the running of the Green Zone is really, it's an experiment in a sort of corporate city state. Right? I mean, the Green Zone is massive. It's a very large part of downtown Baghdad. And it is a corporate state. Everything in it, the water, the electricity, it is run by this one corporation. This is something I think people don't understand. And one of the things I'm arguing in this book is what we're seeing in disaster zones, I mean it when I use the word laboratory. They are laboratories for what happens in during a disaster becomes normalized. And these companies go home and they pitch themselves to local police. There's a new suburb in a new city that has just incorporated outside Atlanta. It's called Sandy Springs. It's a wealthy suburb or upper middle class suburb where the people there decided that they didn't want so much of their taxes going to poor African American neighborhoods around Atlanta. So they incorporated into their own city. So they had to build a city from scratch. Everything, zoning, security, tax collection, everything. So along comes CH2M Hill. CH2M Hill is one of the prime contractors in Iraq. It's also one of the prime contractors in New Orleans after the hurricane, setting up these FEMAvilles alongside Bechtel. It was also one of the prime contractors in Sri Lanka after the tsunami, working for the U.S. State Department. So CH2M Hill, who has practiced in Iraq, Sri Lanka, New Orleans, goes to the people of Sandy Springs, let us do it for you. We'll do it all, everything. We'll set up your whole city. And all of the city employees will work for us. So Sandy Springs has become the country's first contract city, fully privatized, city. So what is practiced in a disaster becomes normalized. And you have these sort of green zone suburbs, right, surrounded by their red zones, by their seas of despair, because the services in those African-American neighborhoods will be even less funded, the public health system, the public transit system, because these gated green zone contract cities, which are now springing up all over Atlanta, all over the suburbs of Atlanta, are keeping their tax revenues for themselves and giving them to private contractors. So, this happened after another shock. You know, there never was a debate. You didn't, you know, weren't sick the day that everyone decided it would be a really good idea to get Blackwater to run the occupation, or to allow Khaki to do prison interrogation. There never was a debate. The first shock was, of course, the shock of September 11th. And what the Bush administration did after that shock was, first of all, deepen it. When I came back from Iraq, I was really interested in how shock works, for obvious reasons. And I read, for the first time, a declassified CIA manual called Kubark. It's online. Some of you may have read it. If you'd like to read it, it's on my website, shockdoctrine.org. Kubark was published in 1963. It is the guidebook for what the CIA calls creative interrogation. It describes methods that we see used in Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib: extreme sensory deprivation, sensory overload, total disorientation, confusion between day and night, stress positions. The manual begins with this statement: everything you're about to read here is essentially a method for inducing regression. Regression. This is an important concept. That's what shock is. It is the transformation of adults to a childlike state. A childlike state when they become scared, dependent, disoriented, looking for parental figures. So it talks about how to put the prisoner into a state of shock through all of this unmaking, taking away their story, their narrative, their sense of who they are. That's what all of these sensory deprivation methods are really about. And then it says that an experienced interrogator will recognize this moment, which is where the prisoner goes into a state of suspended animation, a kind of psychological shock or paralysis, it says. And it's at that point that they start to see the interrogator as a fatherly figure, and it's at that point where they give up the information or the confessions or the renunciation of beliefs. It's in that window of opportunity. And when I read that manual, it really reminded me of September 11th. It reminded me of the mass regression that took place when we lost our story, when there was a gap that opened up between an event and our ability to understand and analyze that event, which is what a shock is. And that moment when far too many of us thought Rudy Giuliani was our long-lost daddy. And we gave things up that we shouldn't have given up in that moment, like the prisoner in the interrogation chamber who gives up things that are precious to him or her. We gave things up. We gave up civil liberties and power. We trusted our authority figures far too much. And if we think about what the Bush administration did in that moment, it's really interesting. You know, I said that they deliberately deepened the shock, and I think that they did, because there was also this impulse. There was also this collective impulse of people to get out of shock fast, which is the natural impulse. People don't like to wallow in shock. You lose your story, so you try to get another story, right? You rapidly try to integrate this event into your collective narrative. And that's what we did. You know, people poured out of their houses. They wanted to debate. They wanted to gather. They wanted to be with each other. They wanted information. They wanted connection. They wanted history. Do you remember how much people wanted history? That's why people were devouring Chomsky in that moment, because he was one of the few people who was putting these events in a historical context. And the Bush administration, what did they say? Well, go shopping, which is the opposite of connecting. And the other thing was that this attempt to understand these events is to be aligned with the terrorists, is to justify terrorism. This impulse, which was the impulse that would have actually gotten the population out of shock if we had been able to integrate that event into a cohesive historical narrative, that would have been difficult because it would have involved looking hard at American complicity in that narrative. That was the impulse, and that was what was cut off so brutally, right? And we were told, actually, not only should you not look at history and not try to understand these events, but you have just been reborn. You are a brand new people. Everything you thought you knew before no longer applies. It's all pre-9/11 thinking. You are a people with no past, no history. You are brand new. And on the receptive canvas of that post-9/11 thinking, we're inscribed a new language, a new crusade, the war on terror, the axis of evil, the war against Islamofascism, the long war. And it continues, and it continues. And I think that this war on history is not accidental. And, you know, Rick said this book, you know, it is, I've been talking about our recent past. I've been talking about our present, really. But this is a book of history. And what I do in the book is I begin in that Latin American experiment, the Southern Cone, the first laboratory for this radical ideology. And I show how it was born of those other two forms of shock, the shock to countries and the shock to bodies. And I follow the crusade through all of its key junctures. And I show that there were always shocks, even though we have this official story that we've been living with, that this ideology swept the globe on the wings of freedom and democracy because people demanded their Reaganomics alongside their Big Macs. There were always shocks. There were always shocks. Margaret Thatcher couldn't have brought the first privatization frenzy to a Western democracy had it not been for the Falklands War, which killed 910 people and saved her career. She went from 25% in the polls to 59% in the polls, and she rode that victory abroad. And she said, we fought the enemy without in the Falklands, and now we must fight the enemy within. And that was the coal miners. And she unleashed the full force of the state on them. And there were people who were killed, and there were thousands who were injured, because there are real casualties. This is a war, and there are real casualties in this war. It was never peaceful. This is the great lie of our time. This ideology leapt forward in China in the aftermath of the Tiananmen Square massacre. They tried to impose economic shock therapy in the late 80s, and the Chinese people rebelled. You know, there were huge strikes and protests, and there were demands for democracy. Why democracy? Just to be like America? That's what we were told on CNN. The students just wanted to be like America. No, they wanted democracy so that they could have accountability for the economic transition. They wanted economic democracy. They wanted deep democracy. They didn't want the elite of the Chinese Communist Party to just become the elite of this capitalist class as they have become and as they became in Russia. So it was a demand to have a democratic transition from one model to the next, and they were crushed with tanks. And that shock, that message of raw terror pulsed through that country, and it created the obedient workforce that has been so profitable and the engine of the global economy to this day. But shock wears off. This is another lesson. There were 87,000 strikes in China in 2005. 87,000 labor disruptions and protests in China. And Latin America is coming out of shock, as we know. And all of these ideas that were crushed by military tanks and think tanks, who I call the people who are paid to think by the makers of tanks. they never won the battle of ideas. They never won the battle of ideas. They just won a series of dirty wars. And so the ideas that weren't defeated bubble back up over time. We come out of shock. And what we see is that the countries that are most shock resistant are the ones where they have metabolized their history, where they have looked hard at their past and have integrated the ugliest parts of their history, looked at their own complicity with repression, and looked at how they lost their rights in the past, and that makes them shock resistant. So that's another thing I learned from living in Argentina. There's a third thing. I mentioned before that there was this uprising in 2001 where people poured out of their houses and overthrew the government. And when we were making this film, we asked a lot of people, you know, how did this happen exactly? You know, we don't really understand how these revolutionary moments take place in North America. Tell us how it worked. Everyone told us the same story. They said, what happened was that, you know, the country was in chaos. There was the looting. There was the storming the banks. There was chaos. People were really afraid. And the president, Fernando de la Rúa, went on television and he declared a state of siege. And he told people to be afraid. And he said, you know, there are enemies that are roving the streets and you have to stay in your homes. And he imposed a curfew. And he said, don't worry, we're in charge. Just stay home. And as he was talking, as he was declaring the state of siege, people started to hear sounds from the streets. And the sound was their neighbors banging pots and pans. And so they grabbed pans and they went out on the streets. And they marched together to the seat of government and banged until the president had to escape in a helicopter. And we said, why? Well, you know, why did this speech so galvanize people? And they said, well, we weren't going to let them do it again. Because this was how it had started in 1976, was that people had been afraid, and they had actually welcomed the coup. They had welcomed the coup. They had welcomed the promise of security, and they had given away their rights. And it was precisely because there had been this hard process of integrating that history that the country had become able to identify the signs. So when they saw their president promising them security in exchange for obedience, they rebelled. And that's, you know, my hope for this book is simply that it will be a tool to make us shock resistant, to make us more shock resistant. Because when we integrate with our past, both recent and ancient, when we have narratives to hold on to, when we are not just running from crisis to crisis, bomb to bomb, when we have a story to hold on to, we're calmer. We are oriented. We can still be hurt. We can still lose. But what we don't do is we don't regress. Information and narrative is shock resistance. I urge you to arm yourself for when the next shock hits. Thank you.
You're listening to Naomi Klein, author of The Shock Doctrine, speaking at Town Hall in Seattle 2 months ago. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. We'll return to the conclusion of Naomi Klein's speech.